All right. Well, we're skipping over our usual Wolfie intro today because I'm not going to try to write dialogue with Christopher Shin in the house. Christopher Shin, an acclaimed playwright on both sides of the Atlantic. He's won an Obie. You've had, by my count, five of your plays have had world premieres at the prestigious Royal Court Theatre in London. Or are there more? Are there more than five?
No, there's five of the Royal Court. Yeah.
And so you have you're having this incredible career, and you're having this incredible life. Although, as we will talk about today, it has been a hard life of late in certain ways. But you really seem to be, just following you on social media, you seem to be enjoying being back on in Hartford. You wrote an essay for The Current about it. You've been having barbecue at Bears. You've been rocking your yard goats swag around town. You're going to be hanging out at the West Hartford Public Library tomorrow night, where you claim to have hung out and haunted the shelves years ago. And now you're appearing on the Colin McEnroe Show. What could be more emphatically local than that? So what's going on inside of you as you prepare to premiere a play at the Hartford Stage Company set in your old hometown, more or less? It's not absolutely, emphatically Weathersfield, but what's going on inside your head? How are you feeling about your old landscapes?
It is exciting to be back. There's memories everywhere. It's really on every street. It's kind of overwhelming to be confronted with all of it. I've never lived downtown here, mm-hmm. and I'm staying here while I'm in town in an apartment. And so there's, it's not just kind of driving in the car and having a passing memory, passing a building, passing Civic Center, now the XL Center, learning the new names of things.
Right.
There's time for the memories to really unfold. And we were down at the New England Barbecue Championships down by the river the other day, and I thought, I can't remember the last time I was down by the river, with any kind of maturity. I think it was when I was a boy watching the fireworks with my dad. Very vivid memories, people down there and how exciting it was and being on my dad's shoulders. And so it's a new class of memory, I would say, mm-hmm. Since I've been back and really had time to let my psyche go and let the memories soak in.
Obviously there's Annabella Sciorra, Mark Lynn Baker, Matthew Lombardo, you. Weathersfield is kind of the Vienna of American theater in a way. Do you feel as though it gave you an unfair advantage being from Weathersfield?
I do remember seeing Mark Lynn Baker's yearbook photo and thinking, wow, oh, that's a pretty amazing. If he can do it, maybe I can do it. So I think it did give me a little advantage to see that you could grow up in Weathersfield and be on a sitcom. Maybe it did.
Well, I had the feeling, and we'll talk about this later, but from correspondences that you and I had at one point, that that you didn't really look back, at least at certain points in your life, with all that much fondness here, that it had seemed, at least at a certain point in your life, kind of a provincial and parochial and possibly even suffocating kind of place. Was that your feeling? I mean, what was it? How did you feel growing up in Weathersfield? Did you feel as though this place is not a good fit for me? I need to be someplace else?
By the time I was a teenager, I definitely felt that. It was a very mixed experience. I have a lot of very fond memories of being a boy. Many of them were solitary, but there was so much freedom to move around into the woods and ride my bike. And I felt like there was tremendous freedom for my imagination to take hold in my fantasy life. And all those things are the reason I'm a writer, that I built up that inner world. And I think that was not only because of the landscape, but I think we had a wonderful public school system, and I have such fond memories of many of my teachers. There was an incredible gifted program at the time. I don't think it's any longer there, which is a shame. But I really felt supported as a creative young person growing up. But I think what then happened was, I was a kind of idiosyncratic lad, and by the time I became a teenager and was in high school and saw social roles start to harden in a stereotypical way, I remember very vividly the feeling that I had one of two options. One was to conform and, have a social network, or I could be myself and really be isolated and alienated. And it was a hard decision, but I remember making it. I remember thinking, I got to follow, you know, who I am, even if that means losing all my friends. And that's pretty much what happened. And it was a pretty lonely, miserable period for quite a long time.
Now, when you talk about that, Joyce, are you talking about obviously being a gay teenager in the early 1990s, I guess it would have been? Or let's see. Yeah, you're born in 75, right?
Yeah.
So is that one of the, is that what you're talking about, or is it also being idiosyncratic, having a fantasy life, thinking about a world, you know, radically different from the one you were inhabiting, or is it all those things?
I think it's both. I think a big part of it was being gay. Nobody was out in my high school. Even looking back, I can imagine some of the students were gay, but nobody was out. Everybody was at least pretending to be straight. So that was a big part of things. It was sort of pre-internet. I remember we got America Online in 1993, so I was 18. So, you know, the earlier years were, you know, it was, you're pretty isolated. You know, I'd go to the library, go to the card catalog, look up H, find homosexuality, see if there are any new books since the last time I'd looked. You know, there weren't many options for really coming out and finding a community back then. But I also think I was an idiosyncratic person. You know, I had been really affected by the books I'd read, the plays I'd seen. And I knew, you know, pretty early on that, you know, I wanted that kind of consciousness. And it just wasn't how people were, you know. So I would read The Sound and the Fury and think, there's something in this speaks to me. Or Streetcar Named Desire, Long Day's Journey and Tonight, these books that really affected me. And I didn't see that world anywhere in my town. And that was hard. And I thought, yeah, I got to get out of here. I got to go someplace where the things that I love, that I respond to, are talked about and thought about and are just a normal part of life.
We're talking to Christopher Shin and his newest play, An Opening in Time, will be at the Harvard Stage opening on September 17th. If you want to go to the West Harvard Public Library and go through the card catalog with him and see what new books they've got on homosexuality, you can do that. It's tomorrow night, right? You're doing a Q&A.
I'm doing, yeah, West Harvard Public Library tomorrow night.
So, there's so many things I want to ask you about. It's sort of hard to pick one. But let's talk a little bit more about that notion of wanting to be a playwright. And so you went to Harvard Stage as a young man, as a high schooler, I think. Was there a moment where you were sitting in an audience going, wait, that's what I want to do. I want to make something like that. Did you have an aha moment?
I actually did have an aha moment. I had seen a number of things. I think the first time my mom took me to Harvard Stage, I think I was 10, saw a Eugene O'Neill play. I was way too young, didn't understand it. But I remember it had a good set, and I thought that was pretty cool. But I remember the moment where I did become self-aware in an exciting way. It was a play called Marisol by Jose Rivera, and I think I was probably 17. I think it was my senior year of high school. And it was a play, I don't think it went on to become particularly famous, but it was a play about a woman in the Bronx in New York City, and it had a kind of magical realism element, but it was really a play about violence and suffering in a contemporary urban environment. And I'd never seen the real world put on stage before that. I didn't really know you could do that. Mm-hmm. And I remember there was a scene in a subway, and the subway was created with, you know, very simple props, some lighting, some sound effects. And there was a homeless man, if I'm remembering correctly, who comes into the subway car, and he's psychotic, and he begins quoting maybe a Raging Bull or something. And it was just so exciting. You know, I've been on a subway a few times, and I thought, wow, you can write a scene in a subway. You can then put it on a stage, and you can show what life is really like. I had no idea. I thought only movies could do that. So once I saw that and felt the power of that, I thought, wow, this is something. I'd always loved writing. I'd always loved performing. But I think that was one of the first times I thought, okay, these two things can go together, and the writing for the theater can be a place where I can really, really express myself.
Now, this the new play is writing for the theater, about theater for young people in a way. I mean, one of the things that's happening here, your protagonist is one of your protagonists. Is a drama coach, and the high school is doing Rent. And that's kind of interesting. I mean, here in Connecticut, we had a recent controversy. I know Howard Sherman is listening right now, so
Howard.
He wants help getting a ticket to the London play too. So we had a controversy, as you probably know, in Trumbull, where the high school was going to stage Rent, and then it wasn't going to stage Rent, and the notion of themes about gay life and AIDS and stuff was suddenly being represented as just too strong a medicine for a high school audience. Was that part of the choice that you made in this play, that a play like Rent is still kind of a battleground for some people?
You know, the controversy about Rent and is it or is it not appropriate for teenagers is not a huge part of the play. But I think one of the things the play is looking at is a kind of blurring of city and suburb. And, it, you know, without giving too much away, I'll say that there's someone who grew up in a city who finds himself living in a suburb. And the show speaks to that character in a particularly meaningful way. And it's not apparent initially to the drama teacher in the play that there would be any relevance for, you know, a show about squatters in the East Village in the 90s dealing with poverty and AIDS to kids in the suburbs. So, you know, one of the ways I use that show is to dramatize a kind of a blurring of city and suburb in a way that I hope will be provocative for people.
We're talking to Christopher Shin, and as we said, the new play is called An Opening in Time. While you're doing this, you are kind of commuting back and forth to London, right? One of your other plays is playing there very soon, if not now.
Yeah, I had the first week of rehearsals here in Hartford. Then I went to London for the first week of rehearsals there. And I came back here, and then I'll be going back there.
And that's Teddy Ferrara. Is that the play that they're doing in London?
Yes, a play called Teddy Ferrara, a play that premiered in Chicago in 2013.
And that's loosely based on Tyler Clementi, right?
Right. It tries to use that case, which, you know, many of us have some consciousness of, as a kind of jumping off point to explore really desire, I would say. It's a play about young desire, first love, in the context of LGBTQ youth and particularly the issues around bullying, homophobia, transphobia that are a part of, unfortunately, part of the experience of young people who are coming out, coming to discover who they are.
When you start thinking about characters in any of these plays, and some of them, many of them have had at least kind of touchstones back in the real world, back in topicality, back in news, obviously you think about all the players and all the stakeholders. And I'm guessing, without being a playwright, without really knowing, I'm guessing that, I don't know, let's say you were writing a play right now with a character kind of like Kim Davis, the famous Kentucky town clerk who won't do marriage licenses, that it's more exciting and more fun to think about that character's point of view, try to imagine it, try to work it out, try to figure out what its reality is, than maybe somebody who's more like you, maybe more like a gay man who's trying to get his marriage license from that clerk. That going inside the head of somebody really different must be kind of exciting and fun, or is it not?
It is exciting, but more than that, I think it's just the way reality works, which is so interesting. People are different. People have different points of view. But not just that, people have entirely different experiences of reality itself, and that's just how life works. And, you know, I think as a dramatist, I'm fascinated by those clashes, whether they're political and social, like in the Kim Davis case, or intimate relationship where two people have different experiences of the intimacy and the challenges and problems of that relationship. It seems like it's an undying aspect of human life that there's always difference. And with difference comes conflict and trauma and pain for lots of people. And, you know, trying to see, is there a way out of the trauma of difference is something that, you know, I think it's interesting, certainly as a dramatist, but it's also central to my life as a human being because I deal with the same traumas of difference that we all do.
Do you think that you – I don't know. I read an interview where you were talking about certain actors, and you said that Eddie Redmayne, who's been in one of your plays, seems really to be inside a character. You know, he's acting from the inside. Do you think that when you do that as a writer, you can get inside that person? You can get inside a character who's not like you? Or are you always seeing in, which I think – is a little bit different from being inside.
I think of it like I'm really them, like I'm really inside them. Now, that could be, you know, completely delusional, you know, and you could argue that we can never really escape our unique specific circumstances. But I think what's so frightening about thinking that way is that, well, if empathy really isn't possible, then all life is a kind of Darwinian battle to see whose point of view will be stronger. And I think that's what leads to violence, ultimately, is you impose your point of view in a violent way, whether, again, it's something political or social or just, you know, in an intimate relationship. So I really hold on to this idea that actually empathy is something that can allow us at least some access to a true understanding of the experience of the other. And, you know, that's why I get, you know, I bristle at the idea that, you know, I have some young friends who are really into social justice movements. And, you know, they'll say things like, if you are heterosexual, you are homophobic on some level. If you're white, you're racist on some level. If you're cisgender, you're transphobic on some level. And I bristle at that. And it annoys me. I think it's just a really sad way of looking at reality. And on one level, yeah, I get it. We should always realize that if we have not had direct experience of something, we're going to have to work really, really hard to understand it. But the idea that we start from a place of total non-understanding and, in fact, violence, active violence that we're not aware of, that really bugs me, and I just don't believe that.
Do you think you could have a conversation with most people who are really – I mean, if I had Kim Davis in here right now – is that her name, Kim Davis?
Kim
in here
Davis.
Right now. Could you guys have a conversation? Do you think you could have a conversation with her where you kind of stayed on a pretty even, curious keel? Or, I mean, what other things kind of –
I flatter myself that I can talk to anybody, and that may be the narcissistic belief, but as a playwright in particular, I've always wanted to feel like I can talk to anybody. Now, talking to someone and just learning about them is easy. If there was a lot more at stake in a relationship, if I wanted to get a marriage license from her, I'm sure empathy and understanding would not be the forefront of my mind. But it's my job to be someone who understands other people. So, you know, I've tried really hard to have a kind of foundational empathy in how I approach pretty much everyone.
Right. I mean, if they'll talk to you, you're kind of on the job at that point. You know, they're providing you with material, with information, and you've got to have information of that kind, emotional, psychological information in order to write.
Absolutely.
All right. We're going to take a little break. This is Christopher Shin. He's a playwright. He's a newest play, An Opening in Time. It will be at the Hartford Stage starting September 17th, which I believe is next week. We're talking to Christopher Shin. His newest play, An Opening in Time, will be at the Hartford Stage. I'm told it starts on Thursday. That's what September 17th is. It's going to run through October 11th. Get your tickets now so you won't be shut out. We have so much to talk about. I want to talk about this just terrifying medical experience you had. You had a fairly rare and very pernicious form of cancer. It's called Ewing sarcoma. And it's clear from your writing and some of the interviews that you've given that obviously in addition to just scaring the living daylights out of you and making you really miserable, do you think it changed you as a writer? Did you wind up thinking about different things as a result?
You know, I mean, I can never know because I can't go and live a second life where I never got cancer. Mm. I feel real continuity with who I was before. You know, I remember thinking before I got sick, I remember realizing that life was, you know, quite fragile. And I remember thinking, what if I died? What if my therapist died? What if my best friend died? What would that be like? That could happen. Those sort of things can happen. And I began kind of playing out in my mind these imaginative scenarios of traumatic loss and how would I endure? And I feel like that, you know, prompted some shifts in living. You know, my dad died of leukemia when I was 26. And I think that too, in a sense, that was maybe the first moment where I really realized, okay, really bad things can happen. They do happen. They can happen to you. How do I want to live in the face of that? And, you know, I'd always been a pretty serious person, but I think that prompted greater seriousness. And I thought, you know, I really want to live a life that I'm proud of and that where I fulfill what I think I'm capable of. So I think my kind of journey to seriousness, you know, began at that point and slowly built up. And, you know, I think getting sick myself just exacerbated it, you know. That became even more important to me. But all the things I was thinking about, I had already thought about. You know, it was just, suddenly the sort of existential dread and uncertainty I had faced previously was now really concrete, really specific. You know, it was no longer abstract. So I think the difference was in that way. You know, my thinking went from, you know, abstraction to, oh, this is actually my real life. And so everything became intensified.
What was the worst part of it?
That's a really good question. The simple questions are always always the hardest to answer and always the best. The worst part of it, I think what was painful was I realized that I couldn't predict people's responses based on what I thought I knew of them. You know, there were people I thought would be really good with my illness and, you know, really be able to face it with me, who just weren't, you know, they weren't able to really think about it and think and feel with me through it. And then there were people who I thought they're going to have quite a hard time, and they were great. And I thought, wow, you know, my ability to read people is not as good as I thought it was. And I saw how extreme circumstances reveal people in surprising ways, positively and negatively. But I think the negative of that was hard, you know, seeing that there were some intimacies that, you know, closed down and shut down in my time of greatest need. You know, that was probably the hardest thing, you know, apart from just the basic physical suffering, which was, you know, extraordinary and frightening and difficult. But, you know, really it was the interpersonal level was the most fraught area, I would say.
It's a very revealing answer in a way, because the physical stuff, I mean, just from what I've read, I mean, you went through some very extreme chemotherapy. This is not for Sissy's chemotherapy. You lost part of your leg. So none of that was your answer. The interpersonal part was the answer. I don't know whether that's the playwright talking or who you are talking, but it's interesting that your thoughts went there, right?
Well, you know, my psyche never shut down. And I remember dreaming very vividly throughout. And I remember thinking, wow, you know, as long as my psyche is alive, then I'm alive. And, you know, in the deepest sense. But I think what that meant was that even in the midst of all that physical pain, you know, the psyche is really concerned, I think, with human love, fundamentally, at least mine is. So, you know, yeah, I was really focused on all my relationships and friendships and all my, you know, my existence in a larger community. And I think as well, you know, you want to feel when you are, you know, basically living in a hospital or a bed, and you're pretty much immobile for, you know, long periods of time, you want to feel like your life is continuing in meaningful ways. So I think that's also why my psyche was more focused on my actual relationships than my actual suffering.
It sort of makes me think a little bit of Angels in America, because, I mean, I think you sort of get that at certain points too, that as horrible as the disease is, the way everybody reacts to the disease in that play is, you know, I mean, it's so front and center, particularly for that one character.
I think that's a great insight about one of the special things about that play.
We're talking to Christopher Shin right now. You did lose part of your leg, and I gather it's made you think a little bit about how people with physical disabilities are portrayed in culture.
Yeah, you know, I'd always thought about it, because there was a disabled playwright named John Beluso who died, I think, in 2006 or 2007, and I'd known him, you know, very well. We were good friends, and I had learned a lot about the experience of disability through him. But again, it was something going from being abstract to concrete, you know, when I lost part of my leg, and even, you know, before that, when I was in that horrible chemotherapy and, you know, trying to get around, when I'd have to get to the hospital and hail a cab, and you know, I remember just once these two women seeing me, I mean, I could barely move, and they basically saw that they could take advantage of that and get a cab that was hoping to hail. You know, things like that, you know, which are pretty unbelievable, to see how easily you can be objectified and dehumanized by able-bodied people when you are disabled in some way. So again, you know, it went from a kind of abstract understanding and appreciation to a very kind of concrete, specific one. And yeah, you know, I think it's something that, you know, someone with at least a little prominence given opportunities to speak about the experience of disability and the importance of really looking at disability and seeing disabled people in a full human way. And I feel, you know, very lucky to be able to do that.
It also, I mean, it unpacks or opens a Pandora's box of all kinds of questions, including, you know, I mean, we have conversations all the time about whether cisgender people should be playing trans roles and stuff like that. And of course, there's this gigantic tradition of able-bodied people playing the roles of people with physical disabilities. I don't know. You have any reactions on that right now?
You know, I just think, you know, people often say it's called acting. You know, that's what they say, which I just find funny. You know, it's like, you know, Mark Wahlberg is somebody who's often cast as aggressive characters. And, you know, you look at his criminal record, you see he almost killed a man. You know, actors are always cast based on a personal connection to the material. It's always that way. So you can say, well, it's acting. Oh, yes, it is acting. But acting is based on experience, actual experience, as well as imagination. So I think, you know, that's a silly argument, you know, and we all know that we value actors having some personal connection to the material most of the time. So I think it's really important that, you know, we continue to advocate for disabled actors playing disabled parts, trans actors playing trans characters. You know, something is gained when you give people the opportunity to play parts where they have a deep personal connection to the material. I don't think you have to make a rule. I don't think it always has to be that way. Eddie Redmayne is able-bodied and was magnificent as Stephen Hawking. There's wonderful performances able-bodied actors give as disabled characters. But fundamentally, you know, it's just undeniable that disabled actors have a particular understanding of disability and that we would all benefit from seeing their understanding and their experience represented through these imaginative scenarios.
I think there's also the question of how a story gets told that has disability or some kind of massive medical challenge in it. You know, is it – and I think I read an interview where you sort of talked about there are sort of sickness plays and sickness movies, you know. And then there's just the whole question of – or the possibility that that a disability is just part of a story, right? That it can just exist within a much larger story, which is kind of more the way it is with life. I don't know. I've become you're making me think, mentioning Redmayne and Hawking. I've become very close to someone who's got ALS, but it's kind of like her life isn't ALS. Her life is her life. It would be wrong to make a story up about her that was only about ALS. But I think that happens a lot in the way people tell stories.
It really does. You know, I think we'll know real progress has been made once we start seeing disabled actors playing characters who obviously are disabled if the disability of the actor is visible, when we see them just playing normal people and they're a part of a story that is not focused on their disability or significantly about their disability, that's when we'll know there's real progress being made.
Because, I mean, the tradition starts the other way, right? I mean, we don't even know whether Richard III had a hunchback. Right? It was convenient to tell that story with him being, you know, disfigured, basically.
Well, you know, I think for able-bodied people, disability means something. You know, I can't say globally what it represents, you know, in a universal way, but it has often been used, you know, to represent some kind of moral evil or corruption. You know, there may be ways that disability makes people think about death in ways that they're afraid of. So, you know, these tropes find their way into disabled characters, you know, very, very easily. So, you know, again, the more we become conscious of the actual lived experience of disabled people, hopefully these metaphoric ways of looking at disability will start to give way to more complex, full human portraits of disabled people.
We're talking to Christopher Shin. I'm just reminding you, his new play, An Opening in Time, opens at the Hartford Stage starting on September 17th. So I read this interview that you did where you said something that I've never, I don't think, heard anybody say before, and I wasn't entirely sure I knew what it meant, but it really intrigued me. I think you said that you felt you almost had seen in recent years an epidemic of emotional self-censorship, that you thought that playwrights, but not just playwrights, that directors and actors were somehow or other afraid or reticent anyway about expressing deep emotion, about sort of laying out feeling. Can you tell me more about that? What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, it's always dangerous when one makes these, you know, general pronouncements.
Right. Never give interviews is my advice.
But. Yeah, I think that's good advice. Because there's always counterexamples, of course. But, you know, it was really, you know, what I said was just based on personal experience, really, where it felt to me like, you know, I started in the theater industry in the late 90s. 1998 was my first play. And it just felt, my experience was that it was easier to talk about deep emotions with producers, artistic directors, actors, directors, when I was starting out, and that it was getting harder and harder. And, you know, I started, you know, just thinking about my life more generally, and it felt to me like that really was a trend, that there is less appreciation for, you know, really, really deep emotions and the complexity of the psyche. Again, there's a million counterexamples, but, you know, that was just something I felt. And, you know, I felt like I had personal experience of, I think, you know, to be blunt, because I had an easier time getting my plays up in New York in the 90s than I did later on, or the late 90s in the early part of the new century. And I was trying to figure out why, you know, and it seemed to me that, you know, the work that was getting done was, you know, a little cheerier, a little simpler, a little more ironic, than the work that I was determined to continue to do.
I was going to ask you, I mean, you sort of answered the question, what, you know, if that were true, what took the place of it? So you're saying a kind of glibness, a kind of entertainment without really rigorous self-interrogation lying underneath it.
I would say that is true. Again, you know, allowing that there's lots of
counterexamples.
Lots of counterexamples. you know, look, I there were plays that, you know, I feel like in another era, you know, Tony Kushner wrote this remarkable play maybe 6-7 years ago now at the Public called The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide. It's a long title. I'll just say the first few words of it. You know, it was an immensely complex play with, you know, just tremendous difficulty in interrogating the human psyche. I think fundamentally it was a play about asking the question, is it possible to be intimate with others without exploiting them? Or are we inevitably going to exploit those that we're close to? And, you know, I mean, it was sort of accepted as a play. You know, it was respectfully reviewed. But, you know, it wasn't – it didn't capture the attention of New York City the way I thought it should have. You know, and that was an example of a play where I felt a healthier culture, a culture that was really going deep and really wanting and willing to ask the tough questions would have seen a masterpiece in this play and would have said, you know, this is something we all need to see and think about and talk about. So, you know, there were things like that where I'd see something very special, very deep, and it wouldn't be received the way I would have expected it to. And more, you know, without naming names, more simplistic work was winning the awards, getting the extensions, going to Broadway. And so, yeah, you know, I think my experience as a theater goer and as an artist was that more difficult things were having a harder time as the decade wore on.
So that raises the question of what you as a playwright want to have happen inside the watcher, inside the audience member. Well, you know, when I walk out of your play, what do you want to have happen when I walk out of this play? I mean, a lot of people, I mean, one of the reasons for the phenomenon that you're describing is a lot of people just want to walk out of a play and think, well, I had a really good time. That was great. You know, I mean, that's, you know, in fact, that probably describes the majority of theater goers. But you want something else to happen, right? So what is that something?
You know, it's a really tough question. The simplest way I can answer it is I want to awaken a feeling in a person that they've never had before and that then they have to think about. You know, it can be a good feeling, you know, but if it feels genuinely new, then I think, you know, something got unsettled or woken up in their inner world. And it means something has progressed, you know, something has emerged that they can, you know, think about and understand themselves more deeply, understand those they love more deeply, think about reality in a new way. But, you know, basically, I feel like, you know, fundamentally, we're limited creatures. We don't know ourselves that well. We don't know others that well. We don't know reality that well. So the point of civilization has to be to learn more. You know, we know this with science, but I think it goes with emotions in our personal lives and human behavior as well. We need to know more about ourselves, those we love, our communities, how we function in the world. So to me, art has to move things forward, ideally, not just distract us or amuse us, but allow us to come to know ourselves better and then be able to apply that greater self-knowledge to our relationships and our world. So yeah, I'm hoping, you know, may sound a little grandiose, but, you know, that's my experience of great art. Something, what is evoked by the artist awakens something that feels genuinely new, but because it's coming, you know, from you, it's based on who you are. It's based on your inner world. And so you then have to grapple with this new feeling and make greater sense of yourself. So that's what I hope to do. I hope to wake something up in someone that then allows them to progress as a human being.
That's a great answer. We're going to go to a break here, but before we do, I have to say that when you were 24 or 25, you woke something up in me. You really didn't like me growing up. You sent me an email when you were a young playwright. We don't have to go into all the details. It's up online anyway. You can read it there. But a lot of it was just sort of, it was an unbelievable, it was the most devastating email I've ever gotten in my life, or letter or anything else, because you were so smart about me. You absolutely had located my most deeply buried areas of self-loathing and self-doubt, the kinds of things that I would wake up in the middle of the night asking myself about. And nobody else had ever said this stuff to me before. So it was kind of a horrifying moment to read this from this young guy who I'd never heard of before. But it was also really interesting. I thought, wow, somebody gets me, unfortunately. But I don't want to do a show about me, but I'm just curious to know. What we've never spoken ever since then, or even at that time, we didn't get a chance to talk. But what did bother you about me? Did I sort of stand for the kind of stifling, suffocating mediocrity of Connecticut suburban life in some way?
I don't know whether to be flattered or horrified by what you just said. You know, it's very it's a real trip down memory lane. I think in my 20s I was a bit of a brat, or a lot of a brat, and I think, you know, a lot of my insights about others, I came to turn the lens on myself, and if it makes you feel any better, my self-scrutiny became equally penetrating and difficult and painful in the years that followed. But, I actually was thinking about it, from a really deep point of view, without going into the details about what supposedly I was angry about. But this is what my interpretation, when I was growing up, I think I always associated you with the Hartford Courant. I think I didn't understand your writing when I was a boy, so I think I was a little alienated. Like, I didn't understand why I didn't understand really what you were writing about. But I also remember I was really obsessed with, at the time, the Hartford Courant film and theater critic Malcolm Johnson. And I think when I was 12, I wrote him this long letter, and I included all these movie reviews I'd written, and I sent it to him in the mail, and I was really hoping for a response. And he never wrote back. And it was, I wrote him a really fawning fan letter. And I think I always was really angry about that. So I wonder if the real motivation for attacking you back in the day was I was displacing my rage at Malcolm Johnson, my childhood rage, which had never died, onto you, because you were there. You were an easy target. You'd made a comment in a piece about a friend of mine. And so I think actually it had very little to do with you.
I will say that at one point I became sort of the Archie Goodwin to Malcolm Johnson's Nero Wolfe. I was probably the kind of person that he would have handed a letter like, do something about this, write back to this kid. But I guess I wasn't there that day. All right, we're talking to Christopher Shin. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. I want to talk particularly about the sort of tradition and the battles that still go on in American theater about censorship. It's a battle that gets fought a lot and has been fought a lot in the Royal Court Theater, where so much of his work gets produced and still gets fought here, too. We'll have other things to talk about as well, so stay with us. All right, we're back. We're talking to Christopher Shin. I feel that did we miss the thank yous? We didn't do the thank yous, yeah. Well, I would like to thank everybody associated with this show, especially Lydia Brown, who helped out producing today, and Kyone Wolf, who's on the board, and Greg Hill, who's tweeting for us. By the way, you can tweet to us right now at WNPR Colin. I should have said that a long time ago. Christopher Shin's new play, An Opening in Time, is opening at the Hartford Stage Company. This is something I know that is a close to your heart and close to your mind subject. This is kind of a whole question of, we talked about emotional self-censorship in the previous segment. But censorship still goes on, and not just at Trumbull High School over rent, right? There's still battles about what can be staged where. And the Royal Court Theater, where so much of your work has been, Carol Churchill's Seven Jewish Children had a very, very rocky run. New York Theater Workshop, which I'm a big fan of, had actually pulled back from a play called My Name is Rachel Corrie. I mean, there's still you sort of feel like in 2015, what's left? What's a frontier? What can't you talk about except feelings and emotions? But it turns out there's other stuff you can't talk about, too. And does it surprise you that these battles still go on? And I assume it bothers you, too.
It doesn't surprise me. I think, because it's the power of the inner world. If you awaken something in someone that they don't want to be true and real, usually they have a hard time with it, that seems to be something that's not changing, unfortunately. So, yeah, intellectually, we all know that censorship is bad and shouldn't happen. But I think emotionally, it remains too tempting to too many people when something threatening gets woken up inside.
So does that put some kind of burden on playwrights, on theater companies to do that work? I guess I'm asking a pretty obvious question. Of course it does.
Well, look, there's the emotional level, too, which I think is more insidious and more subtle, Where, of course, we know, you know, seven Jewish children, or Rachel Corrie, you know, often the rent in a high school, you know, the explicit content of a work is why it ends up running into trouble and difficulty. But, you know, producers are making decisions all the time. And, you know, I think one of the things they think about, maybe the first thing they think about, is will audiences like this? Mm-hmm. And so often what happens is if they think the audience won't like it, they just don't do it. And, you know, where I grew up thinking art, you know, it was the opposite. That if art does something difficult and people won't like it, that's even more reason to do it. And I think one reason I was discovered at the Royal Court is that I think that's more part of their tradition. That they do work that they know, you know, some people are not going to like or appreciate. But, you know, there's a subtle, insidious censorship that goes on where we never see the work because someone determines, you know what, you know, this is not going to be appreciated. Our subscribers won't like it. So, that, you know, that happens too. So I think, you know, the censorship question, you know, there's a broad spectrum of censorship, what constitutes censorship and why things are censored and how they're censored. So I think it's a really important, you know, discussion that we continue to have.
We should say that at the Royal Court in the 60s, the Lord Chancellor had to sign off on British plays. And I know the Royal Court did two incredibly controversial plays that the Royal Chancellor had not licensed, right, at their peril. So it's a good place to be thinking about those kinds of questions. But you know, the other thing that gets that I think we thought was, okay, so for there's a lot of reasons why certain plays don't get done or don't get done as much. And some of them is maybe some of that's because they're too controversial. Sometimes it's because they're too hard. I mean, when the Hartford Stage Company did Richard Foreman's Pearls for Pigs, it wasn't that it was too controversial that there was anything in it that somebody really objected to. It was just too hard to watch, too difficult to watch. The stage company actually had this rotating gig among their staff called goalie. And the goalie was the person who had to stand out in the lobby and not stop people from leaving, but just kind of talk to them, interrogate them, find out a little bit, you know, about what was bothering them, make them feel as though they were heard. They had community forums and talkbacks to talk about this thing, you know, and it wasn't because it was about some kind of forbidden content. It was just really hard. But you kind of think, well, isn't regional theater, isn't that where all that stuff was supposed to go once Broadway got to be too expensive a place to do it?
Right. Yeah, that was the idea. It hasn't really worked out that way. I mean, you know, the Hartford Stage is great and there's great regional theaters all over the country. But, you know, you can't imagine Hartford Stage or any major regional theater giving Richard Foreman a slot in their season. I mean, it's literally
not anymore.
Not anymore. It's literally unthinkable. That will never happen in our era. So, you know, I do think things have gotten harder, and it is sad. You know, I think there was a dream that, you know, the regional theater movement could, you know, discover things that were challenging and bring them to New York. And now it's more like whatever was a hit in New York, you know, finds its way to the regional theaters. So, you know, it hasn't worked out the way some people thought and hoped it would. And, you know, it's making it harder and harder to figure out how you get difficult work in front of an audience in this country.
Is London easier?
I think it is easier. I think part of it is that there's still, you know, meaningful subsidy. But, you know, the subsidy isn't huge. I mean, I was looking at, you know, some budgets of theaters and, you know, they're still raising private funds and they're making money from ticket sales. So I think, you know, there's a culture there that supports the theater, you know, more robustly. It's part of their daily lives, I think, more than it is here for Americans. So I think it's the combination of, you know, cultural pride in doing difficult work, having a tradition of doing difficult work, and, you know, the still meaningful subsidies that that these major companies receive.
I just got a tweet. I think it's from Howard Sherman that it was Lord Chamberlain, not the Lord Chancellor. It's the Lord Chancellor's nightmare, maybe, and Gilbert and Sullivan. I don't know. I probably made a mistake there, too. All right. So I'll stop saying those things. So, well, I mean, subsidy is a double-edged sword, too, right? I mean, the minute there's government money involved, then you have big debates about, you know, Karen Finley or Andre Serrano or, you know, and if there's private subsidy involved, if there's anybody involved that's not just the most pure foundation, then you have a regional theater thinking, well, geez, our underwriters, our funders, you know, are they going to like this?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, there's dangers either way. If you have to choose between corporations and government, you know, I would choose government. I think it's probably better. And I think, you know, again, it's hard to know how much these funding realities affect programming. But, you know, I have to think that, you know, if insurance companies and banks are major funders of your season, I think it affects, you know, what kind of stuff gets done. And, you know, the artist is someone who is trying to disrupt society. I hate that word disrupt, but I just used it because
it used to be an okay word.
It used to be. It's now overused. The artist is trying to wake things up in a way that, you know, is frightening and challenging and confusing. And, you know, that I think is not a corporate value, to put it mildly.
We're talking to Christopher Shin. I should say, today, it turns out September 8th is Transatlantic Playwright Day on the Colin McEnroe Show, because last year, exactly on this day, we did an interview with Tom Stoppard down in New Haven, and now we have Christopher Shin. I don't know who we have to figure out who we're going to have next year. Maybe send in some nominations. You're working on a musical, right? Or you have worked on a musical?
Yeah. I have a musical that a wonderful young composer named David Hancock Turner, wonderful director named Evan Cabinet, who did Teddy Ferrara at the Goodman in Chicago. It's a three-person musical. It's very, very intimate. And we're doing a workshop with the New Group in New York City in January. And, you know, it's exciting. It's about a million miles away from Hamilton, but I'm hoping Hamilton, by being somewhat new, is going to open the door for some new kinds of musical, because our musical certainly, you know, has some radical elements to it, and very, very excited about it.
It's about Millard Fillmore and Martin Van Buren. I think we should say that. It's also just, it's a different form, right? Okay, for you, it's a really different form. It's so hard to be naturalistic in a musical, right? People just don't burst into song ordinarily.
They don't burst into song ordinarily. Music is so powerful. It's mm-hmm. so emotionally powerful. I mean, when we were starting work on the musical, adding singers and, you know, hearing real voices do it, I just thought, this is a whole different thing. There's a sensual reality to it that is just, you know, not, to me, there's no parallel in straight playwriting.
So does it feel like a beast that you can't control? You're doing the spoken word part of this.
Yeah. I mean, my job, I think, is to find a way to control it as much as you can, you know. The emotions are so powerful. So once they're evoked through music in the audience, it's my job to sort of bring them back down to earth and contextualize and, you know, build the structure that will support, you know, emerging into the depths of emotion that music brings the audience. So it's very, very challenging. It's very, very exciting work, but very different from what I usually do.
And it sounds like you liked it, though.
I loved it. I mean, I love collaborating. It's why I'm in the theater. I love working with people. You know, a play is ultimately a problem, you know, and there's not an obvious solution. And everybody ideally has to agree on the not obvious solution for the collaboration to go forward successfully. So, you know, it's just so intimate. You know, you're using all of your brain, all of your soul, all of your heart to try to figure out some aspect of truth that is, you know, fundamentally hard to grasp, if not impossible to grasp. So it's kind of, you know, it's an impossible problem that you set out to solve. And, you know, to me, there's no more fun than that.
All right. Here's my concept. I always try to make sure the guest leaves with something, you know, besides what they came in with. Kim Davis, the musical.
There you go.
You know, because first of all, you could work in a kind of Kentucky sound to it, right?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It gives you a couple of different musical genres to play around with a little bit. I mean, you have to rush this into production. I mean, nobody's going to remember who she was 3 years from now.
Yeah, the 11 o'clock number is God's authority. I can hear it now.
Yeah. Who could play Kim Davis, though? Who could do that role?
Oh, wow. That's a good question.
Because casting, I know from reading about you that casting is really important to you.
Oh, it's casting is at least 80% of it. There's no obvious musical theater star, but Laura Benanti can do literally anything. So although she is much prettier, I should add, than Kim Davis, I'll start there. I think that's a good place to start.
Right. And our Kim Davis is going to have to be a lot prettier anyway.
Of course.
We can't sell tickets.
Of course.
All right. We have to stop right now. Christopher Shin has been great to come in here and talk about so many different things with us. So now it's your turn. It's your turn to go get your tickets to the new play and opening in time at the Harvard Stage Company. It starts next Thursday, so I would get on the phone right now.